You probably aren't aware that over the weekend, 750 detained immigrants went on hunger strike out in Tacoma, Washington, protesting delays in their deportation cases and in the conditions of their detention facilities. You probably know nothing about the Colorado case of Raul and Judy Cardenas either, and their three kids. The federal government was trying to deport immigrant Raul, even though he was married to Judy. Their only recourse to prevent their family being broken up was a hearing before an immigration judge.
The prosecutor didn't even have the file. The file's with DHS because of the requests we've made. The petition is still pending. The marriage petition is still pending. And the request for prosecutorial discretion is still pending.
That inconclusive 8-minute hearing took place back in 2011. In 2012, the administration changed its deportation policy, however, and the Cardenas case was eventually closed. But as of this month, the Obama administration will have deported 2 million immigrants, illegal and legal, for various offenses under a court system that is universally understood to be overworked and understaffed and faced with the conundrum of Congress's inability to enact meaningful immigration reform. For judges, this can be beyond frustrating. We spoke to Judge Dana Marks, president of the National Association of Immigration Judges. She joined us from KQED in San Francisco, where she's been an immigration judge for 27 years.
We believe that we are at a crisis point in terms of a lack of resources. Public debate rages on about exactly what complexion the law should have in terms of what rights and benefits are afforded to non-citizens of the United States. But the immigration courts are an often forgotten piece of the immigration removal process. More money has been spent on the immigration removal process than any other law enforcement initiatives, federally speaking, combined. And yet the immigration courts have remained a stagnant afterthought in terms of funding.
And what is the consequence of that stagnation been in the style of the proceedings, the extent to which due process is actually given to immigrants?
Well, there's an adage in law in general which states that justice delayed is justice denied. So in San Francisco, for example, I have 2,500 pending cases on my docket. That means that it takes more than a year for someone to get their first hearing before me, and that hearing is simply an arraignment-type hearing where we triage and try to figure out what we need to do to bring that case to trial and make it ready for a trial. And at that arraignment-type hearing, it's then another 2.5 to 3 years before I can even get a case to my final docket. I'm currently setting cases in the fall of 2017. To give you a perspective nationwide, there are now approximately 360,000 cases pending before immigration judges, and the current staffing of the immigration judge corps is only 233 sitting immigration judges with an additional 15 immigration judges nationwide whose primary responsibility is supervisory and management.
Would I recognize a court proceeding that involved an immigrant plaintiff or defendant?
We call them respondents in immigration court proceedings. And the biggest difference is the fact that people do not have a right to appointed counsel. They have the right to provide an attorney at their own expense. But nationwide, 60% of the cases proceed to hearing without an attorney representative. And if you consider only the detained docket, people who are incarcerated during the course of their hearings, 85% of those individuals are not represented by counsel. We record our proceedings on digital audio recordings rather than a court reporter, so the judge has to make his or her decision without a written transcript. And we have a layer of complexity that most courts don't face. The vast majority of the cases that come before an immigration judge are presented through a foreign language interpreter.
The ABA back in 2009 made a number of recommendations to fix the court or address some of these concerns. They wanted the hiring of additional 100 judges. Did that ever happen?
No, it did not, and we're still hoping for that sometime soon.
There was also a lot of talk in the commission report about how There's a wide variance in the quality of the decisions on the part of judges. The standardization of training for immigration judges is not what it should be, and that even Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez addressed some of these concerns in 2006, attempting to upgrade the quality of the judge corps. Did any of that happen?
The short answer is no. I can't speak to policy in my role as the National Association of Immigration Judges, but I can say that it doesn't serve anyone's interest to not have adequate resources at the immigration courts. Some people are cynical and believe that non-citizens benefit from the delay and try to encourage delay in the system since it allows them to remain longer. But the judges don't believe that that is true on the whole. People with meritorious cases can suffer grave injury to their case because of the fact that they can't bring their case to hearing. There are certain benefits under the immigration law which require a qualifying relative who is a minor, or a qualifying relative who will suffer exceptional or extremely unusual hardship. Often that hardship is medically related. So people lose their qualifying relatives due to the passage of time because they reach the age of majority, or sometimes, tragically, due to death because their case is not heard in a timely fashion before their loved one dies.
What's the longest time that you're aware of a respondent who was incarcerated during a delay of the kinds that you're speaking of?
It is true that the Executive Office for Immigration Review prioritizes the cases of detained non-citizens so that they are not languishing in a detention facility. But it can be years on end between the actual proceeding before the immigration judge and the various appeals processes that are available afterwards.
You've seen people in that situation, right?
Yes, I have. People are often very surprised to learn that a stress study done of immigration judges showed that the level of stress in our corps in 2009 rated immigration judges as high on the stress and burnout scales as prison wardens and busy hospital room doctors.
Have you ever felt as though respondents have fallen through the cracks in your court system at some of these very brief hearings that you understood on some level that the verdict you were delivering was not necessarily going to represent justice, but there was nothing you could do about it?
There are times that immigration judges are called upon to make very difficult decisions. There is no doubt that the immigration laws are extremely strict at the present time. For example, someone convicted of petty theft with a prior conviction is considered to be an aggravated felon under the immigration definition of that term. That has very harsh consequences. That can mean that someone who has been a lawful permanent resident from the time they were a small child and had no other criminal activity except for repeated petty thefts can be precluded from remaining in the United States, which may be the only country that he or she knows, that person can in essence be exiled from the country that has become their home.
So you have the power to tear up a family over someone who's shoplifted.
I have the duty at times to separate family members. If I find that the law itself does not allow me to consider some kind of relief from removal for that person. And when Congress tries to micromanage every outcome by making the law so specific, as it did, for example, with petty theft with a prior being an aggravated felony, and of course we know it's certainly not aggravated, and it may not even be a felony in some situations. When those kinds of decisions are predetermined, instead of being allowed to weigh all of the factors, both positive and negative, it does not achieve as just a result. And the immigration judges are fighting to try to get some discretion back into the courtrooms. We're members of our local communities. We don't want to allow someone that's going to be a danger to the community to remain any more than people in Congress do. But we need to have a more refined tool to use to evaluate that, rather than the broad categories which simply preclude the immigration judge from using his or her judgment to make that determination. We need more discretion in the law to allow the judges to weigh those factors and come to a fair and just result.
I'm curious, what you describe as a fix here, getting the immigration court system out from under the Attorney General's office in the Department of Justice and making it an independent Article I court, that's a recommendation that's been around since the early 1980s.
That's correct. But law is glacial in its speed for change. The National Association of Immigration Judges has been fighting for years to accomplish that. We have gained the support in that cause and since 1981 by getting organizations like the American Bar Association and the Federal Bar Association, extremely prestigious legal groups, to endorse that concept. And now it's our job to convince Congress and the American public that this is an essential step which needs to be taken soon.
Judge Marks, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Judge Marks is president of the National Association of Immigration Judges. She's been an immigration judge in San Francisco for 27 years.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.